Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 122, recorded July 16th, 2012.
Greetings all.
Hello.
Shall we begin?
Yes, we are going to hear from Andreka in Oregon, Jason from we don't know where, and Carlos in New York.
Cool. Okay. Well, what does Andreka have to say? Oh, well, didn't she leave us a message?
Yes, she did. So we're going to listen to the message first.
Okay.
Hi, Russ and Kelly. This is Andreka. I was calling to ask some of my latest questions. If you buy a fish from a pet shop and you don't know how old it is, how do you know when your fish is getting old? Like if everything kind of looks normal, but they seem to be kind of slowing down and like in our tank, our 29-gallon Cassius Arbeta is, he's kind of lying on his side and just kind of seems pretty beat. And but his fins look fine, and everybody else is seeming totally fine. So I don't know how old Cassius is, and I was just wondering about that. Also, I was thinking of another top 10 list. What would be your top 10 list of why to get a tank, like why to start getting into keeping fish, and what are your top 10 reasons of why to get out of fish keeping? So those are my latest thoughts, and I've been enjoying the show as usual, and hope to hear what you have to say. Bye-bye.
So thank you, Andreka, for calling in. Let's talk about this, aging fishies.
Indeed. Well, aging in fish is something that, it's an interesting topic, and there have been academic papers written on it, because some species of fish don't seem to age very fast, and other species do. For example, you look at sturgeon, they don't seem to age very fast. There are fish, there are rockfish off the coast of California that, you know, can be over 200 years old and things like that, or something to that effect. So some fish don't age very fast, but then you get others like bettas that do age in a fairly short period of time. So let's talk about that. First of all, when you buy a betta in a store, assuming you buy a mature betta or a relatively mature betta in a store, because you know some pet stores these days are selling very, very young bettas.
Very small, yeah.
That they label as baby bettas because that's what they are. But I would say, from what I've been able to determine, that most bettas you find in a store are somewhere between 3 months to 1 year old.
So it's kind of a big range.
Yeah, it is. And bettas, of course, can live anywhere from 2 to 5 years or so.
Which is also a pretty big range.
Big range, mm-hmm.
What's the average that they live?
Probably average 2.5, somewhere around in there.
Okay, maybe. So you might have your betta a year and a half or something if it's a year old when you get it from the pet store.
Right, and there are plenty of people that have, you know, have bettas that live to 3, 4 years old, but five is kind of an exception. Anyway, that's so it's hard to tell how old Cassius might be. He might be on the further end, you know. Might have already, if they Andreka indicated in a follow-up message that they'd had Cassius about a year, so he could be 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
If they already got him when he was a year old,
15 months old.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. But, let's see, some of the classic symptoms of fish aging, and some of these are more specific to bettas, but of course a more lethargic fish is often because it's older, you know. As fish become older, they often become more lethargic.
Put other fish in there and they go, "You young whippersnappers, stay out of my tank!"
Exactly.
Messing up my plants!
And with bettas, it could be, you know, you'll see less flaring and things like that.
Because they're too tired.
Mm-hmm. Less bubble nest building, things like that. Color changes is not uncommon. And in this case, Andreka could mention, you know, her betta is changing color. A part of his belly is getting lighter. So it's mm-hmm. a very light blue. And I've heard that areas around the head in older bettas can sometimes turn lighter.
Like going gray?
I guess. But
yeah,
I don't know
about that.
I don't know anything specific about that, but I've heard about it. I know that bettas as they age will often change other colors too. Like our daughter was better when we first got it was mostly, well, it was a butterfly, but it was red interior colors and blue outer colors. And the blue was kind of a light blue. And now it's mostly red with some blue left over, but it's very dark red, and the butterflying is less clear. Mm-hmm. You know, red is a common color that will become stronger in bettas. Sometimes the iridescence and so on will fade in bettas. I did find a couple of links that I'll post on the show page about aging, one specifically in bettas and the other one just in fish.
Did it have some pictures?
I may have had a few pictures. But, yeah, we'll give that, we'll put that up, and that may help. One thing to note, though, is that as they age, the changes should be fairly gradual. If they're not...
If it's all of a sudden.
If it's fairly quick, then it may not be aging. Maybe something else. It could be a disease. And one thing to just to ask is what temperature you've got Cassius at. Because, you know, a lot of these symptoms can be mimicked by just temperature decrease. And although that seems counterintuitive in the summer, it could be, you know, your AC's on more and temperature's going down and whatever. But, of course, if you have a heater, that shouldn't be such a pronounced change. But... if the temperature is anything under about 77, that could be a factor by itself. So that would be enough to account for all of those things. Well, maybe not so much the color change.
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully that helps a little bit. And it could be that Cassius is just getting along in years, though, if you know, if he was already a year older before. All right, so our next point, hopefully that helps a little bit, Andreka, and we'll move on to your next point.
She has some more top 10 requests for us. So the first list of top 10s she wants is top 10 reasons to start keeping an aquarium, to get into fish keeping.
Yeah, and I think that's a great one. Well, the first thing I would say, number 10 on the list, is that fish are more interactive than people often think of them as being. You can train fish. Fish can learn to recognize individuals and act differently towards those individuals than they do to other people. So, that's kind of fun.
It's very good. Number 9 is that they can be a lot easier than some other pets. They can take up less space and time than many other pet companion options.
Right, and that's not always true, but it can be. I mean... if you think of the amount of care that it takes to take care of one 55-gallon tank in comparison to a dog, for example, yeah, that's...
Mm. And they're different kinds of care.
You know, certainly.
Yeah, but yeah. Cats probably take less time because cats are just low maintenance.
Yeah, and that may be true, but many other pets.
Yeah, and a lot of pets. Number 8... biophilia.
Basically just the idea that humans often react to the proximity of other organisms in a positive way. They like to be able to view them and so on. It just seems to be, at least according to some people, a natural need of many humans. I feel that way.
Yeah, we like to be a part of things. We like to have variety in life around us, unless there's some of the weird people who have been raised without pets and in the middle of the city and think animals are weird, but I don't think those people really count as people anymore. Number 7.
I don't know what number 7 is.
Oh, well, here, read it.
Okay. It's not just a pet, it's an ecosystem. Because with fish, it's one of the situations in which you can keep, you know, different plants and invertebrates and fish all together. Or in a marine tank, you can keep photosynthetic organisms like corals that have zooxanthellae in them, and clams that have zooxanthellae, so they photosynthesize, along with shrimp and worms and all sorts of things along with the fish. So
it's a whole system.
Yeah, and it's challenging in a different level in some ways, but it's very, very fascinating to look into a tank and see an organism there that you didn't put there on purpose, and but it seems to be working in the ecosystem. It's pretty fascinating. So there you go.
That's a good one. Number 6, it's educational.
Yeah, I think not only in terms of education, like studying fish and using them as a model for Mendelian genetics, which you can do and which is interesting, but in so many other ways. For example, have your kids calculate a volume of a tank, so they're doing math. Or learning more about chemistry by testing the nitrogen cycle and talking about pH, you know, things like that. Also, just really basic life lessons. It's in some ways less traumatic for a child to learn about death by watching a snail die in the aquarium instead of finding out firsthand through their grandmother's death or something.
Yeah,
like
that's the first thing that they've ever seen die. If that's a family member, that's a lot harder to deal with than if it's something in the fish tank. Number five is you can actually be a part of species survival plans.
Yeah, there are aquarists out there who dedicate tank space and time to making sure that a particular species of fish, maybe it's a native fish, maybe it's a fish from a different country, whatever, making sure that species does not go extinct, making sure that its lines remain pure. Perhaps it's a variety of fish from a particular locality, maybe a killifish or a cichlid. It's a particular strain collected from a particular area, and they no longer exist in the wild, or they're threatened in the wild, so they're helping to keep that genetic.
To breed them and produce more so they can replace them.
Right. So that's kind of a cool thing.
Number four is that you get to meet cool people, and it's an interesting way to meet people.
Right. We've met a lot of very interesting, fun people through Aquarimax.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a good conversation starter from the other side. A lot of people who aren't particularly into aquariums or anything like that just find out that when they walk into our house, for example, they're interested in seeing what we've got and asking questions about it and so on.
The first thing that you see when you come in our front door is the opayula, and people are always like, oh, what's that? What are those? Do you eat them? And then they see our other tanks and, oh, what's in there? And do you have more? And so it's a fun way to start a conversation. Number three is that you can actually help contribute to the body of knowledge, piscine knowledge.
Right. One of the factors here is that a lot of the knowledge about particular species, about breeding them and so on, has been obtained not by aquarists in a professional capacity or by scientists who are, you know, doing studies for peer-reviewed journals, even though those can be very important to the hobby as well, but just by hobbyists who keep something and they find out that the conditions they're keeping it under help it breed, and then they tell other people about the conditions and other
they
people
keep
are able
a journal
to replicate
on it.
Right, and they make the difference between fish that are collected in a non-sustainable fashion and fish that are bred in a sustainable fashion.
Number two, and this is a big one, is stress relief.
Oh, indeed. That can make a huge difference in my stress levels, being able to look at a fish tank. I know that when I have to go a long period of time without seeing one, I just get a little more restless and don't feel quite as calm.
A little more restless is an understatement.
You
are not a happy camper.
It helps me relax.
Fish.
That's probably why whenever I go to a conference somewhere out of state, I make sure I go to an aquarium during that time.
Yeah, or if we go out on vacation to California to visit my parents, we take a betta with us. Zoe has a fish for the 2 weeks that we're out there.
Well, we have done that before.
Often.
But even when we don't, we
go, to the,
we go to the pet store at least once.
Yeah.
So we can check out fish.
In fact, I remember several years ago, we ran into the same woman various times. I think one at a pet store and then a couple times at different thrift stores that happened to have tanks that we were looking at that she was just about to buy. And she sat there and told us like her whole life story about how she was horribly depressed, and her therapist told her to start keeping marine fish tanks, and then she was totally cured. And it was really funny because I don't think she remembered that she'd already met us and talked to us several times, but it was really cool that it helped her, but it was funny. And the number one reason to keep fish is that they are endlessly fascinating and varied.
And I've noticed that this applies in several directions. For one, you can have a tank with the same species of fish in it for 3 years, observe it every day, and notice something different very, very frequently. Something different, new, and interesting very, very frequently. And on the other hand, say that you've been keeping a particular species for 10 years and you think you know all there is to know about it, and maybe you're getting close, but then you start with a different species and it's all new territory. Mm-hmm. So there you go. I mean, there are things that will help, but you're going to be observing new phenomena and enjoying yourself a lot.
There's always something new to learn or new to see. Try. Okay, before we go to her next top 10 list, let's take our break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
Okay, we're back. We're going to continue with Andreika's top 10 requests. Her next list she wants us to do is the top 10 reasons to stop keeping fish. The reasons to get out of the hobby, which was not as fun of a list for us to come up with, and much harder. And I don't think we actually came up with 10 reasons, did we?
I couldn't, but I came up with a few. And I don't think all of them are very good reasons, but... One is that...
I just thought of another one.
What?
You die.
Oh, that's a pretty good reason. We should put that as number one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's one. That's a pretty good reason. And the next one is, if you realize you don't know enough and you won't be able to scale the learning curve in time to save the fish you've got. So maybe you realize that rehoming the fish is probably the safest method and the only method to keep them alive. You know,
so
suddenly,
when would that...
Say somebody gives you fish and you don't know anything about them.
They just drop them all off to you and say, here, I don't have these anymore, you have them.
Right, something like that. Or somebody gives them to you as a gift and you
or
just...
Or somebody else died and you inherit them.
Right, and you have no idea how to take care of them. And you realize you don't have the resources to be able to learn what you need to be able to take care of them. I imagine that could be a reason.
Okay, that's probably a situation that would warrant not keeping the fish. Number 9 is if you don't have access to the resources that you need to take care of the fish.
Like, say you move 2 hours away from everywhere, and the only water you can get is well water, and it happens to be really bad water for your fish, and you're having a hard time doing partial water changes often enough or something like that. I mean, it's kind of an extreme example, but it could happen.
Number 8 is if you are moving to a place where logistics would prohibit getting them there.
So I temporarily, I guess you could say, left the hobby when we moved to Hawaii.
Well, I wouldn't call it left the hobby. That was just me.
Well, it was just temporary, yeah.
You know, some people, if they had to redo everything from scratch, they wouldn't want to start back up again.
Right. And that's understandable, I guess. It wasn't what I did, though. I couldn't take my fish there. It just
when
wasn't...
we moved to Hawaii.
It wasn't practical to take them to Hawaii, but I did get fish about a week later. I bought someone's tank. They had a cycled tank that they didn't want to keep anymore with the fish in it, and so I bought that tank, and that's how I started out.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was starting over for us, but we did keep going. But I can see how a lot of people, if they're moving, wouldn't want to start all over from scratch.
I guess.
Because it's a lot of work.
I guess. Okay, what's next?
Next is number 7. If you lose interest, it's better to find them a good home than flush them or neglect them.
And I have heard of people doing that.
Which is very sad.
And so I think it is better to, you know, give someone else your fish than just let them die or actually hasten their demise. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Number 6 is if you're not prepared, you know, you start getting into it and realize you're just not prepared for the investment of time, money, and effort that it takes. Which, you know, can be big or small.
Right, and hopefully someone would have considered that beforehand, but I guess it's kind of a reason. I mean...
Well, and a lot of people get into a pet on an impulse and they haven't really researched it.
Yeah, and I think downsizing is probably a better thing to do in that case, because a lot of times people leave the hobby when they get burnout, when they really would have continued to enjoy it if they had just done it at a reasonable level. And so they need to find a level that's good for them and not surpass that. If you can handle keeping 3 tanks, don't get more than 3. You know, if you can only keep one and you're happy with that and it works for you, don't get 2 if you can't.
Mm-hmm. So, as I said, we had trouble coming up with this whole list. So, number 5, 4, and 3, we don't have numbers for those. We're going to skip to number 2.
Okay.
So, number 2 is if you are no longer able to care for the fish physically, emotionally, or financially, which is a little bit the same as number 6, but number 6 is like when you're first starting out and you just didn't know what you were getting into. Number 2 is you've been doing this for a while and You just can't anymore. You don't have the money. You don't have the time for whatever reason.
Or you have a long and serious illness and you just don't have the energy you need to be able to do it or something like that. That could be a valid reason. I mean, things like that happen.
Mm-hmm. Number one is if it cuts into your relationship so that it's hurting them.
Right. And I think any hobby, if it is taking enough time and energy and so on so that it's damaging relationships that are important to you, you gotta make a change somewhere. And that fish keeping is no exception. So there you go. Kind of a sobering thought, but I don't know. I think Kelly's going to stay around.
You're a lucky guy. What can I say?
Yep, I am a lucky guy.
Thank you, Andreka, for always giving us such interesting things to talk about.
Yeah, that was fun. Okay, so our next topic is with Jason, isn't it?
Yes.
Jason, who left an Aquarimax comment, so we don't actually know his location.
Right. Jason, the mysterious secret agent.
So would you read his email for us?
Yeah. He says, I have a 55-gallon freshwater tank, and I'm starting to get black hair algae. I'm looking for a more natural way to get rid of it, like fish or invertebrates. I do and have had a mono shrimp, ghost shrimp, and four autos. I have read that black mollies will eat it, but I have two of them, and they never touched it. I have planted an anacharis to kind of try to starve the algae, but so far no good. Is there anything else I can try?
Yeah. Okay, well, Jason, this is a great question, and there's some good things you can do that may be able to help you. I don't really know what your situation is in terms of your tank. It's 55-gallon freshwater, and that helps, but how long has it been set up? What kind of substrate you have? What kind of plants do you have in there? Where in the tank is the algae slow showing up? Sorry. Like, is it in places where there's high current in your filter outlets, or is it on plant leaves or on rock work or different things like that? But what's your plant load besides the anacharis? You have anacharis, but do you have two strands of anacharis? Do you have, you know, a third of the tank planted? What kinds of situations do you have there? And in terms of other plants, what do you have? Do you dose the tank with plant fertilizers? If so, which ones? How much? What is your water changing regimen? What are the dimensions of the tank? You told me that, 55 gallons. I can guess it's probably the standard 55. Can you describe your lighting system, your photo period? And is there anything else in the tank in terms of livestock besides what you already described? And if you can find a link to the photo of that algae, that could help, or just send me a picture of it. That might help as well. But that said, Jason, just some other ideas that may help you. One thing to try, I don't know if you've tried Siamese algae eaters. You didn't mention trying those in your email. So those might be an alternative or a possibility for you. I've noticed that they do eat black beard algae, which may be the same species you're dealing with. And they do a pretty good job in taking that out. So one possibility for you would be to try Siamese algae eaters. I know it can be hard to get them, and it can be hard to find the correct species because there are several species that look fairly similar. So maybe do a little research on how to identify the correct species and get those. They can get aggressive as they get older, so that's a downside. But they are good with the black beard algae. Another possibility, you might want to look into using some safer chemical controls rather than the commercial algaecides. There are a couple of things that people use. One is Flourish Excel. Is not marketed as an algae control chemical, but it is sold to enhance plant growth in aquariums because it's a source of carbon that plants can use instead of carbon dioxide. And it has been used just kind of spot shot using a pipette or something of that sort directly at algae, and it can have a bad effect on the algae, and the benefit is that it helps your plants. You do have to be careful with the dosages, but you can look into that. Another possibility is, similarly, hydrogen peroxide, not sold specifically as an algaecide, but when used correctly, can be an algae control, but I would advise doing research on that as well.
How do you use it? I mean, you don't pour it into the tank.
Well, it can be used in a diluted fashion. So
in the tank?
In the tank, yeah.
So you just pour hydrogen peroxide in the tank?
It's a possibility, but you can't just pour it in. You have to measure it and everything. Uh-huh. Make sure you're using the right concentration for your tank and so on. But something to look into, some people use barley straw, which as it decomposes, releases hydrogen peroxide in ponds. And you can also use that in tanks, conceivably, to control mm-hmm. algae. So something to look into. I haven't done a whole lot with that, but at least you could look into and do a little research on it. I don't advocate just getting a bottle and dumping it in. So. Hopefully, there's some ideas there that'll help. I have had situations where blackbeard algae has been a problem. It's been a few years since that has been the case. But I did resort to Siamese algae eaters as one of the control mechanisms, and they helped me out.
So thank you, Jason, for your questions, and let us know the rest of your situation. Now, Carlos has responded to Juliet's problem with her beta.
Oh, yes, good.
She has a female beta.
And a male beta.
And a male beta. And the female seems to be quite heavy with eggs, but nothing's really happening.
Right. The male and female have engaged in the spawning embrace, but no eggs are forthcoming. The female is very large and rotund, and the male is quite a bit smaller than the female.
And Carlos says, I'm a little stumped since the male does not actually squeeze the eggs out of the female. I have seen females just drop their eggs, because she was wondering if he wasn't squeezing.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can think of is that perhaps the female is egg-bound, and with a smaller male, he can't fully wrap himself around her. I'm definitely going to look into it further.
So thank you. Those are some ideas, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you, Carlos, on that if you find out some more information.
Explain to us exactly what egg-bound means.
Egg-bound means basically the female has eggs. They are ripe or mature and ready to be laid, but she, for one reason or another, is unable to expel them.
They're stuck.
Yes, and this happens with a lot of species. It happens with birds. It happens with fish. You know,
anything that lays eggs.
Well, I am, you know, can't speak to the experience of with some species, but I do know specifically that, you know, it does happen in a number of species, not just fish. So,
okay.
And there are various ways to deal with that, but I don't know what the mechanisms would be for dealing with fish with that problem.
And the smaller male, he says he can't fully wrap himself around her, but they don't actually squeeze the eggs out of him, so why is that a problem?
That's a good question. It may have to do with the stimulus. Maybe being wrapped around entirely is what encourages her to release the eggs, or tends to encourage her. She feels just, you know, the tactile stimulation of the male on both sides of her, something like that. I don't know. That's just an idea. Could be.
Okay.
Speaking of bettas, we are having a little progress with ours. We've got a male who's got a lovely bubble nest. It's one of the bigger bubble nests I've seen, actually, and he's quite enthusiastic about it. He's very interested in the female. She seems interested in him, too, but for some reason they're just not going through the whole thing. But he's very gentle with her. He's interested in her, and he flares for her. He tries to lead her over to the nest. He succeeds in leading her over to the nest. She seems interested in the nest and in him, but they haven't done the spawning embrace yet. So they're still together. We're just checking on them frequently and seeing how things are going.
Having a nice slow courtship, not rushing into anything.
Right. One nice thing is that he's not being at all aggressive in terms of...
He's being a gentleman.
He hasn't attempted to bite her or anything, but he's very solicitous for attention. But we're glad that he's not being mean.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen...
May the fish...
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.